We are recording.
We're recording. So, man, I don't even know where to begin with this one. We're here in West Virginia, I guess, there, with Josh's grandpap, Al Mershott, and one of his old buddies and one of my old buddies, Keith Castile, a custom gun maker. And if you've listened to my podcast and if you listen to Josh's podcast, I'm the Ryan Fuhrer podcast, and Josh has
Blood Money, actually.
Blood Money, yeah. We've talked about both of these guys multiple times, I guess, just because of what the influence they've had on how Josh and I grew up and what we've done. We've talked about this for a long time, yeah, especially. But for me, just to give it, you know, I just mentioned that to Al here a minute ago, Josh's grandpap, I'm 47 years old, and one of the reasons that I started hunting, especially out west, or just fascinated with that type of lifestyle, was because of Al Mershott and his wife Bonnie. Back in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, you guys were going out west on a regular basis when no one around here was. I don't say no one, but very few people. It wasn't as cold as it is now to do. But go ahead, Al, tell us about
it. Well, I had my sports shop and Delton Archery and muzzleloaders, modern rifles, just getting to know all the guys in the general area, the tri-state area. And every year, Bonnie and I would go out to Colorado for our first hunting in general. And my son Jim and grandkids and that, they would watch the store till we got back. But we made several trips out, elk hunting, mule deer hunting in Montana, and mostly elk in Colorado. And I did mountain lion hunting in New Mexico, elk hunting with muzzleloader in New Mexico. So I've been around the loop a little bit. I've enjoyed it all, and thank God for my health that I was able to do it.
So, right, and you're 81?
I'll be 81 this coming August.
And just to let everybody know, you just told us a little bit ago, he still gets up and works every day.
Yeah, I'm still working for my son, John, and I'm there 5 days a week. That's enough for me right now.
Right. And you mentioned muzzleloaders, and we've all been, and everybody in this room has been brought together probably by hunting the outdoors and a flintlock muzzleloader. And we're fortunate enough to know one of the best that's ever been in the business of building custom muzzleloader rifles, and that's Mr. Keith Castile, who I introduced a little bit ago, sitting right next to me. What do you think, Keith?
Yeah, it's still been a good life. It's been a good life. Started out with me. I was a coal miner. Yeah, in my early years, I was a coal miner. I bumped coal on the solid and mined the whole hard way. And where you just paid $1.25 for a ton of coal.
So what year did you start coal mining?
Right out of high school.
What year was that?
1954. Now, I was blessed when I was in high school that I had shop, and a shop teacher had recognized something about me. He thought I had a little talent, and I didn't know it, didn't know how to spell it. But he saw I had a little talent, and he looked to me and said, "Keith, would you like to learn how to engrave?"
Oh, really? That was a high school teacher?
High school shop. And I said, yes. And so we went into it and had to make our own tools in shop. So the other people was working on wood. I was working on steel and filing out and the way he told me to do it. And I worked on tools. Got them all made, and he and I one evening drove down to Morgantown, West Virginia, to the university, and went in there and tempered all of our tools. Now, that's unheard of, too. But then I engraved a plate, a serving plate, an aluminum serving plate, one day in shop. Took me 3 or 4 sessions to get it done. It was a cardinal sitting in a pine tree. And he liked it so well, he said, let's send this out to Ford Motor Company and see what it'll do. They had a national competition going on at the time. And I didn't know what was going on, but he sent it all away. And a few weeks later, come back and I took first place.
That's how it all started.
I was on high. I got to go up on the stage in high school, you know.
So you were born and raised right here in West Virginia, right?
Yeah.
What high school did you go to?
I was actually born in Pennsylvania, just across the line. And little lumber camp called Shinbone.
I know Shinbone very well.
Brought in this world with by a full-blooded Cherokee woman.
Really?
At home, lived and born at home. But in the middle of summer, but it's went on, and I guess she must have vexed me or something, and it stuck.
Your native heritage.
It is very stuck with me. But yeah, it went on from there, and when I got out of high school, I'd been engraving. I engraved dinner buckets underground with and tools that I made and carried with me, and while you're sitting in a dinner hole waiting for them to bring you more empty cars. Here I am in there engraving on somebody's loom the dinner bucket, and I had all these dinner buckets. I wish I could find one of those again today, you know?
Yeah.
But I had Santa Claus all over and everything that you could think of on those dinner buckets, but I was learning something.
Yeah.
And then somebody else found out that I could engrave, and he asked me if I could engrave a couple guns for him. So I engraved a couple muzzle-loaded rifles for him that he had built from Independence, West Virginia. And I done what he told me, wanted borderlines only, so I done all kinds of borderlines with my tools and a few little flowers here and there. And he is so happy with it that it wasn't long to here come a guy with a double barrel shotgun he wanted engraved. So I engraved that, and next thing you know, there was people doing engraving every night at home. I was engraving mine and Cole today. And then it turned out I studied more about becoming a mining engineer, and I was asked to put a processing plant together in Barrett, West Virginia. Got away from engraving a little bit, but it was into another skill. And I went to work at that, and the second year I was there, I built a processing plant, designed it, and surveyed it out and put it all together and got it running, and mined it underground for the first belt setup, which would be 1,000 feet underground.
Oh, wow.
And we got it going, then they shipped me to Southern West Virginia. And I was working down there for a while, but all the same time, this thing of building a rifle was sticking with me, because I'd come back home and I'd go see my grandpap. And one day I talked to my grandpap about engraving those guns, and he said, you know, the old home rifle, I loaned the old home rifle to my brother-in-law that lives up on the mountain here. He said, why don't you go get that old muzzleloader? So I went up and talked to him a little bit about it, and they got the rifle out, and they said, no, he said, that belongs to our dad, grandpap. And I said, well, does it have a shield on the inlaid in the cheek piece? And he said, yes, it does. I said, that's my grandpap's gun. He loaned it to him to kill some hogs with. So anyway, I paid him for it. I gave him $75 for that gun so he could get it back in the family. Mm-hmm. Dad, grandpap said, get it before they turn it into a crowbar. But I brought it home with me, and he and I set it together, and he was skilled at that, fooling with the guns, and we took it out and shot it in. And I brought it home, and I used it. I shot groundhogs and all kinds of stuff with it.
That was a flintlock?
No, it was a percussion gun.
Oh, percussion gun.
So now I still have that gun.
Uh-huh.
But it spurred the interest in it, and I said, well, I don't want to shoot this old gun to death. I want to build one myself. So I used it as a guideline and built a rifle.
Well, let me stop you there, because not only were you just you've turned into one of the best custom gun makers that's probably ever lived, arguably, but you were also a hunter, a hell of a hunter, is that? Because I'm looking around the room here, and I was fortunate enough on a hunting trip with you before, and yeah. I know you've done a lot of hunting, so I'm assuming your family were hunters when you were a kid.
We hunted all the time. We hunted not for sport, but we needed the meat.
Right.
We had 7 kids in our family. And I had a trap line. I had a trap line when I was in grade school. I had a trap line. It wasn't just for sport.
Right.
That trap line brought meat home.
Oh yeah.
And I worked that trap line. But later, yes, we were all hunters, big hunters. But it wasn't for sport at that time.
What did your parents do?
They were coal miners.
Coal miners.
Everybody was coal miners. My grandpap was a farmer. And he worked the farm, and I'd go down and help him a lot.
Was he on the Pennsylvania, in the Pennsylvania?
No, he was at Hazleton, West Virginia.
Oh, okay.
Place there. But yes, coal mining pulled me away from it for a while, but my heart was really still in building rifles. But I built a rifle or two, and found out that somebody said, "Hey, can you build me one?" Well, I said, "So what to build for?" Because parts then, a whole complete set of parts for a rifle in right that time, wood and everything, was $100. I could take that $100 worth of parts and make a rifle and sell it for $200. Oh. I made $100, buddy.
You're living. What were you making in the coal mine then, you think?
Well, I was making about $25 a day. I was more than anybody else. And most people working outside made $10 a day. If you work in the stores or if you work in the coal tipple, it was $10 a day. Or maybe not that. Sometimes some of the jobs are only $8 a day because $1 an hour is what you made at that time. And I work in the coal mines. I make three times that. I could make $25 a day.
Wow.
So if you had to just go ahead and work at it.
Yeah.
But you could make more money if you went to the coal mines than what you could work in the bank. And so it pulled me that way, but no, I was a hunter. But the hunting then stuck with me, and but my goal was eventually to start hunting out in the West. And one of the reasons why is because here in Preston County, there was very few deer.
Right.
There just wasn't any deer around the area. Now, we could show you hunted all small game.
If every family was hunting for meat, took probably quite a bit of the deer off the landscape.
Back in the 50s?
Yeah.
The 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
Now, in the 70s is when I really got started. I built rifles in the late 60s, but a few rifles. I still have some of those recorded in a book at home. I drew a little picture and showed the rifle. And but those guns sold for $150, $200, $250.
What are they worth
then
now?
Later on, somebody told me, said, "Well, you built me one of them rifles?" And I said, "Well, what do you want to pay for it?" He said, $1,000. And I said, "What?" I wanted to say, "They're not worth that kind of money." But so I went on and building those rifles. And when I had time, until it turned into a business.
Right.
And I could get away from the coal mines. Coal mines, Ann and I was moving all over the place to keep, because I was a mining engineer. I'd get a processing plant started here and got it running. Then he wanted me to move someplace else and start another one. We moved the family like 10 times in 15 years.
Oh, wow.
And so the last time they wanted me to move, I went home and told Ann, I said, "We're going to have to move. We've got to go to Southern West Virginia where the action's at. So we'll put the house up for sale and make a move." And she looked at me kind of puzzled and she said, "We're not going." I said, "What?" I didn't sleep much that night. The next morning, I went to work and told the boss, I said, "I'm sorry, but I'm not going to make a move. We're going to get out of it. I'm going to do something I've wanted to do all my life." He said, "What's that, Keith?" I said, "I'm going to start building muzzleloader rifles the rest of my life." And he about fell off of his chair. He said, "You are crazy." Well, crazy as it is, I'm still here. But the guns... I found out something about building the rifles, that you could build the rifle to do just about anything you wanted it to do. And so big game was my deal. I love seeing great big animals hit the ground. I like to see big animals hit the ground. And so I started building bigger guns, 50 and 54 calibers. I saw that they was a lethal weapon. And out west I went. It wasn't long till... I firmly believe that if a man is a good whitetail hunter, that he can hunt elk. And he'll do the right things if he keeps that wind in his face, mm-hmm. You know. And so a real good whitetail hunter can kill elk.
Right.
And it worked well for me. And I wouldn't use the muzzleloading rifle if it didn't do it.
Right.
It didn't work for me. But I shot an elk and down it went, you know. And an antelope, I shot an antelope at 225 yards, shot him directly in the middle of the chest, and the bullet was laying underneath the skin next to his hind end at 225 yards.
With an open sight flintlock,
right? Open sight flintlock, yeah.
What caliber? 54?
It was a 54 at that time. I had it set up for elk.
Right.
For long range elk hunting. And then went on to Colorado and killed an elk with it, too.
Hey, Keith, before it goes any farther, I want to talk to you about what you thought about. You said that elk or whitetail hunters would make good elk hunters. I could make a strong disagreement with that, and I would like to know how much. So, and you guys,
the whitetail hunters he's talking about,
that's what
are different than the ones you're dealing
with.
Yeah.
Well, it even would go to, you guys probably didn't start hunting out of tree stands. You were on the ground with the deer.
Right. All hunting on the ground.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, you didn't have a four wheeler. You just ride out there and pop up over your corn pile.
No way. No, this is all true, honey. This is on the ground.
You killed deer.
You had to know the wind, you buddy.
Do you have your Ozonix and all that? I know. Killed deer on the ground.
On your head.
It can be done.
Wow.
That's what I was getting at.
Go ahead. I was going to say, let's jump over to Pat before we get too far in the hunting bush, because I know where this is going to go. We got another seasoned hunter here.
Yeah, well.
How'd you get started in it? I know it's been forever.
Well, actually, my starting in the hunting was when I was about 6 years old. My mom and dad had a fish hatchery down in Elizabeth, Pennsylvania, about 55 miles north of here, and we raised what they call fathead minnows, and we sold them for bait for people to fish. Well, everybody's familiar with a kingfisher, which is a bird that dives into the water and can eat one fish at a time. But the thing that they don't realize is that the fathead minnow, when it deposits its waste in the lake, and the kingfisher deposits its waste in a lake when they're flying around, the two can come together, those wastes, and they can call what they call a black grub. And the black grub can completely wipe out a whole lake of fish. So my father made me a deal. He said, here's a single shot 22 and a box of 50 ammo. And he said, I'll give you 50 cents for every kingfisher you shoot.
Well, you were in business.
So I become a paid hunter at probably 6 or 7 years old. That's really when I got my love for hunting. And then in the mid-50s, my uncle on my father's side built a cabin up in above Tub Run on the Taylor Road, and we used to come up here and hunt turkey and deer, because all we had back in my home was, besides kingfishers, was rabbits and wild pheasants, which was great hunting. But there was never any deer down there in that part of Allegheny County when I grew it up, so we'd come up to the mountains and hunt squirrel and grouse and turkey and deer. I kind of been a hunter since.
That's where it started. And at some point, your paths crossed.
I have a possible bag sitting here beside me. I was getting into this flintlock shooting, and I had a great friend by the name of John Cunningham that Keith trained. He turned him in. He was a truck driver that became disabled and started building muzzleloaders, and Keith shared a fortune of wisdom with him. So, but I had John building me a gun, but I needed a possible bag, and they said that if you want to best possible bag there is to go out to where Keith and Ann's shop.
Excuse me, Pap, I don't want to cut you off, but people are not going to know what a possible
A possible bag is what a muzzleloader guy keeps everything in. Bullets, flints, patches, a knife, a ball starter.
I had somebody ask me just this year, I had a possible bag on, and they said, why do they call it a possible bag? I said, because you need everything possible to kill a deer.
That's for sure. So I met Keith and Ann, and I have the possible bag with me today, sitting right here off my right shoulder as we talk. And
what year do you think that was?
75, 76, somewhere in there. Yeah, in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. And I still have it, and I treasure it as one of the finest little leather things that I have. Everybody needs a possible bag if you're going hunting.
That's it, right?
We call it a hunting bag.
Yes.
A lot of them call it a hunting bag, too. I have the original hunting bag that goes with my grandfather's rifle.
Do you really?
Yeah, and it was still in good shape. I had it for probably 10 years, and it had some bullets in it. And I noticed one day when I lift up the flap and put my hand inside the bag, that front layer that holds is part of the pocket, the leather was rolled over from his hand going in and out of that bag so many times, it just rolled that edge of that leather over. And I kind of straightened it back up there a little bit, and I saw there was two layers there. I thought, wait a minute, what's this all about? So I opened up the two layers and peeled down in it, and there was his turkey call, a wing bone of a wild turkey. That's just a treasure to me.
Oh, yeah. You still have that?
It still has the bite marks where he held it in his teeth.
Who was this?
On that wing bone, a wild turkey.
That's amazing.
Isn't that something? To me, it's just as much of a treasure as a gun is.
So I would imagine he made his own hunting back then. And what kind of rifle was it?
It was a 36 caliber rifle. A couple guys were in my shop, and one of them was saying, I'm going to change my powder charge this year. I'm going to 125 grains of powder because I can't seem like I can kill a deer with 100 grains of powder. The other one says, well, I think I'm going to have to do the same thing because I can't seem like I can get any penetration. I can't seem to knock one down with 100 grains of powder. I'm going to 125 or maybe more, 135 maybe. I said, I can't stand this, man. I'm going to run up to the house, and I'm getting my grandfather's shooting bag, and I was with him the time he killed the last deer he killed. And this deer was hanging around at the farm there, and it was behind the barn. They had a calf lot there, and they had a calf that had fattened up or raised and up. And this young deer had come down over the hill and feed in that calf lot, and Grandpa would leave it alone all summer long with that deer. You'd see it about any time in there eating food out of that calf lot. But later on in the fall, when about Thanksgiving come, Grandpa said, well, let's get the old rifle. Says, we're going to go hunting today. So I was just a little feller, but he let me go along with him. We walked down to the calf lot, and there was that deer. And they're just eating away at that food, and Grandpap had me over to the gate, and he says, you stay right here. And he went step through the gate. He don't put his eye, he don't look at that deer, you know, don't put your eyes on him whenever you're hunting him. And he didn't look at the deer, he just turned his head away and had the rifle already loaded. And he walked out a little piece, and he's about 30, 40 yards from the deer, and he pulls up, and boom, he shoots. Down goes the deer. And me, I'm sitting there like a hunting dog, you know, waiting ready to go, ready to go, to go. And he walks on out the deer, and it wasn't quite dead. It was kicking, so he flip, 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 and he had the gun loaded again, and boom, he shot it in the head and killed it. And then he turned to me and said, come on. Boy, you know me, I ripped through that gate and threw across there, and I tell everybody, I plowed, jumped on that deer, and I grabbed it, and it was a biting of sear, you know, like a dog. But I didn't really just tell people that. But
so just for time frame, what year was your pap born?
My grandfather was born about 1880.
So this was all taking place when you was a young kid. Then what year were you born?
1936.
1936. So we're talking back in the 40s, whenever, probably when you was a young kid when he shot the deer in the feedlot. It's interesting. It's crazy how it doesn't take a long time for time to change, you know, in the grand scheme of things. You know, here we are, it's 80 years later, man, how modern technology has advanced the sport so much.
There was other guns he could have picked up and went down there and shot that deer with. We had other guns in the house, 30-06 or something else, but he chose to take that muzzleloader. But I said, now I'm going to go get that shooting bag, and I'm going to find out how much powder charge he used to kill that deer. And so we ran it and grabbed it and brought it down and measured the powder charge, and how much powder do you suppose he used to kill that deer?
40 grains.
Yes, 25 grains of powder. 130 to 125, 150 grains. I shot my grizzly with 150 grains of powder, and shot him at 70 yards. And I know what 70 yards is. I've surveyed a lot of years, and I know 105 steps for me is 100 yards. And so stepping through the tundra, it might be a little bit different, so I applied for that. And so at 70 yards, my grizzly was, and I shot him with a 58 caliber rifle using the Civil War bullets that made out of wheel weight lead. Because with 150 grains of 3F powder behind that bullet, it was blowing the skirt off of it before it got to 50 yards. And so I had to make them out of wheel weight lead to make that skirt stay on. And it just shot like a laser then. I was blessed with that hunt too, because when I shot the grizzly, he was broadside to me at 70 yards, and I just pulled up the rifle offhand, and boom, I shot. And the gun just don't go boom when you shoot 150 grains of powder. It goes boom, hum, 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 hum. And knocked the grizzly down, and he rolled around in the in the tundra, but I didn't look at the grizzly. I looked at my guide back there. I didn't want him shooting a hole in my bear if I could help it. But he had a hold of his rifle by the barrel, and I could see the red and whites in his fingernails where he was gripping that rifle. And then reloaded, and I pulled up again, and now the bear was turned to, he was sitting down facing the river now, where we just came up out of. And I just pulled up and boom, hit him again. And then he rolled over.
How fast could you reload that rifle, Keith?
That rifle?
Yes, sir.
With a grizzly bear in front of you?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I want to know.
With a wounded grizzly bear, it doesn't take long.
No. I'd say about 20 seconds. Was it no patch?
Oh.
I don't use the patch.
They're skirted bullets.
It's a skirted bullet.
Okay, skirted bullets.
I shot the third shot there, and he was laying there and didn't move, and the guide said, hit him again. Well, I pulled up the rifle the third time, and kaboom, I hit him again, and I was shocked, because just as soon as the gun goes off, my eyes is back on the grizzly again. And when that bullet hit that grizzly, the water went spewed from his hide, and I thought it blew him up. But it was just the water. It was all, he'd been brought around that tundra and it had been raining all morning.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Then it was it starting to set in. The grizzly's laying on the ground, and our guide said, you got him, you got him. But now he's starting to holler, hey, bear, hey, bear. And I said, what's he doing? He says, I want him to move if he's going to.
Mm.
If he's going to move, let him move. While we're here, all of our conversation was loud conversation then, and tried to get the bear to move. And I said, now here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to wipe this barrel out. I wiped it out. He said, we're going to approach that bear, so you get that gun loaded. So I said, I'm putting powder in the barrel. I'm putting powder in the barrel. And so I know I got all the powder. Okay, I'm putting a bullet in the barrel. I'm putting a bullet in the barrel. Okay, and the bullet's on top of the powder. And I kept talking loud because of the bear, but I didn't want to know, should I do it right? And got it all done. And I said, okay, now I'm going to nap my flint. I'm going to nap the flint to make sure it's nice and sharp. So I napped the flint and put the powder in the pan. And then I closed it all up and I said, okay, I'm ready. So now he says, I'm going to walk out there about 10 yards and I'm going to kneel down and I'm going to aim the rifle at him. Now you walk out past me 10 yards and then you sit down and you kneel and aim at him. Then I'll walk past you 10 more yards until we approach the bear. He had it worked out, so I had to approach the bear first. So I walked up to the bear, and I was looking at him in the face of the bear, and he said, watch him, watch him. He said, if he moves his eyes, if he whispers, he does anything, pull the trigger on him. And he was aiming at him, too, and I'm now only about 5 feet from the bear, and I pulled slid my ramrod out, so it stuck out about a foot and a half out in front of me. And I eased up the bear, the gun cocked, aiming all the time at his head, and when I got right up to him, I stuck that in his eyeball and shoved that ramrod right on down in the thimbles again with an eyeball. And then I went over and gave him a kick in the chin, and I said, hey, I think he's dead.
Oh, yeah.
So that's all this, you know.
That's impressive.
You was announcing as you were loading your gun case,
yeah.
So that bear heard you and knew you had had everything in order. Because
yes,
if you get them out of order, those guns don't work.
Well, you know what happened? All the same time, we were both blessed, because usually what happens when you shoot a bear, if you wound him in any way, he takes off for the alders just as fast as he can to get into the alders. We were standing in the only alders that there was alongside that whole river right over there. So chances are he'd have been heading for the alders. He'd been on our lap.
Man.
And you wore your buckskins on this hunt?
I wore buckskin clothing, yes. And they were there still yet today. If I went to Alaska to hunt, my buckskin pants would be with me. You can wear them 10 days. They don't stink like your regular clothes does.
Like wool.
Like wool or anything else. I wore a Woolrich jacket, a Woolrich shirt with a cape on the back of it to help keep you dry, and a coonskin cap. I'll get pictures of it. The coonskin cap, I was sitting on a bank one day, and here come an owl with the white owls, Arctic owl.
Oh, Arctic owl.
And it was flying my way. I thought, he sees my hat. So I took the hat off and threw it on the ground out there in front of him. Now he went, landed right beside my hat. And then he saw me, and he spread his wings over out like that and hissed at me, like he was going to try to shoo me off. And I thought, he's going to carry my hat off. I don't want that to happen. So I really got onto it and shoot him off there. I think he would have carried off my hat.
Was that the only animal that you killed on that hunt?
No, I killed a moose the same day.
Really?
I hunted 10 days without shooting anything. And on the last, we had one more day left to hunt. It was actually the ninth day of the 10-day hunt. On the ninth day, the guide said, Keith, it doesn't look like we're going to get a bear. We saw 105 grizzly bears in 10 days. And we had made a bunch of stalks, but that wind up there was just kissing us every time we turned around. And he is a heavy smoker, and coughing and smoking all the time, had an awful time with him. But we finally that day, he said, we're going to have to give up. He said, I don't think we're going to bear. I said, well, he said, let's go see if we can kill a moose. The moose were scarce that year, so we went over on the river, the Chateau Lake River. Now, you don't just walk up the river, as you well know. But we heard two moose on the other side of the river. We didn't know where they was at the time, but we could hear them crashing their heads together. Well, it turned out there's two moose on the other side of the river. And we had, but we was trying to get farther on up the river to get closer to them and find a place to get across because the water was swift there. When it's swift, it's deep. I started to go up the side river, side stream, and I looked up and I saw these great big antlers way up there. And I said, stop, 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 there's a moose. I said, you stay here. I'm doing this myself. He was smoking a cigarette, and I made him stay there, and off I went up the side stream, and it was probably 100 yards away, and I crawled on my hands and knees for a while till I got up right beside that moose. Within 35 yards of him, and he was standing in the creek, checked my prime, made sure everything was right, now down and cocked her rifle back, raised up to my feet. I raised the rifle up and aimed at his shoulders, not more than 30 yards from me, and I said, hello, Mr. Moose, meet little Ephraim. Ephraim was the name of my gun. Kaboom, I hit him, and he threw his head back, and his knees buckled and slammed down to the creek and slid down the rocky creek the bottom there. And here come the guide running up to me. He said, what on earth were you doing up here? I said, I had to talk to Moose before I shot him. But I said, no way he could have got away from me. It just wasn't going to happen. And the moose was laying out there going, blah, 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 because the head was below water. And he said, shoot him again. I said, shoot him again. I don't want to blow him to pieces. He says, shoot him again. You're not going to blow that moose to pieces. Go, boom, I hit him again. He never moved.
Typical guy, keep shooting.
He didn't have a gun. He didn't have nothing with him. So we went off to the side to get on the moose. And that moose is so big, you know what they are. Oh, yeah. That moose is so big, I stepped up on his hindquarters and walked on his body down between his antlers. And when I got down his antlers, and he said, how big is he? I said, I don't know. We didn't have a tape measure. He had one, and I didn't have one. Now we can measure it. So he come out there with a tape and measured out to be 71 inches wide. So
that's a dandy with a flint wall.
Yeah.
And I noticed in your story you called your gun Ephraim.
Ephraim, yeah.
What's
yeah,
that?
That's, I know what that name comes from. Go ahead and tell that, sir.
Yeah, grizzlies. That's a grizzly.
Yes, sir.
That's the grizzly.
Mountain men back in the day, they when they got in fights with the bears while they were doing their trapping in the West, they would call them Old Ephraim. And many times Jim Bridger and lots of trappers in those days referred to the grizzlies as that.
Yeah.
But then we was carrying meat and stuff back to the plane, and we turned around and looked up on a ridge in the direction of where the moose was, and we saw a bear. A big blonde bear. That was my goal, is to kill a big blonde bear. So we took off right past the moose to go get the bear. And so after we went up there and shot the bear and gunned him out, and now it's raining, of course. It rained all the time. And then back down the river we went, we're carrying the bear hide with us. He stopped there where the moose was and looked around, and the cape was gone. And so you could see where it was drug out through the woods. And he said, I got to get my cape. He says, well, let's see if we can find it. And we went out there about 50 yards, I'd say. And there was my cape, but he had already ate the nose off of it. Messed it all up. He said, wolves. Wolf got a hold of it. And I said, I don't think a wolf got a hold of that cape. That thing must weigh 200 pounds. I think a bear got a hold of it, because we never ever saw a wolf, but we saw tons of bears.
I've had the pleasure of hearing this story, and I know why he's seen so many bears, because he walked through three inner linings of his boots.
We just wasn't sitting in the same spot.
No, we was just covering ground.
We've done a lot of walking. I had the moose's head, I caped it out. We just carried it back to the plane to fly back to camp. On our way back, you don't go into tundra, it's too hard to walk, so we walked a creek edge, and there's a high bank on the side there. As we was walking down through there, I seen my guide stop, and he's staring up to the right, and so, oh, what's he doing? And I stared up to the right, too. And here stared a bull, a giant bull. So he had to be an 80-incher, he's anything, gigantic thing. And he's standing there staring at me, and all he could see was great big antlers. And the guy said, watch him. He says, if he lowers his ears, if he bristles his neck, shoot him. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to get to shoot another moose. I'm going to get to shoot another moose. So I raised the gun up, but I couldn't get the gun up because the antlers was pulling my shoulders so hard that I couldn't get the gun up. So I had to get rid of them antlers. And the moose is still staring right at me. And I went ahead and popped them antlers off my shoulders when they're on the backpack and lowered them down to the ground. When I lowered them down to that creek bottom, they've hit that. There's rocks and things on the edge, and they went clunk, 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 that's what laying them down. Now, moose threw his head in the air and whirled around across the tundra he went.
Oh, I figured it would work the other way.
Yeah, scared him off.
Now that's an adventure.
What year was this?
1977. September 1977.
What's some of your favorite hunts, you think, looking back, both of you? What your favorite?
You know, I've hunted by myself a lot. But the one that I really, really enjoyed and had more fun with was taking my wife bear hunting. Because we worked so hard at it all through the summer.
You mean in West Virginia or somewhere else?
I took her to New Brunswick.
Okay.
I knew the people up there and knew they had a good bear area. She kept saying, one of these days I'd like to hunt a bear. And I said, well, we'll get started. We'll do that. So I went and bought a bear target for her to shoot at. Every day, every evening after supper, we'd go out there and shoot and shoot and shoot. Wouldn't just shoot the bow. You're going to shoot till you get three shots, all the same ones. She shot two Robin Hoods with two shots.
Oh, wow.
And they're both was in the bullseye, too.
Oh, good, yeah.
She shot two Robin Hoods. She was a crack shot with the bow. But we went up there and got set up. The guy said, you got your license, Keith? I said, I don't have a license. But I said, my wife's going to hunt. She's going to be the one doing the shooting. He said, your wife's going to do the shooting with the bow? Tell her she can use a gun up here if she wants to. She don't have to use that bow. If she wants to kill a bear, she can use one of these. And I said, Ann, let's go out back and let's shoot a little bit. I knew we had a range set up back there. And so they heard what that said. And so she got her bow, and out the back we went. We got us set up to shoot. Then here this guy had walked out, and he was going to get firewood. But he was looking at her shooting what he's doing. And she sat out there and went, boom, dead center, boom, dead center, boom, dead center, boom, dead center. Six of them straight in a row. Came back in. He says, I don't think we'll have any problem with Andy doing the shooting. So I put her under stand, and I was doing the camera. She's doing the shooting. Here come a bear. Walked right into the bait, and I says, don't shoot that. Not too small. He's a little feller. So she didn't, but she sat there and looked at him, looked at him, looked at him. I wouldn't even let her draw the bow back on him because I was afraid she'd trigger it, you know. So I just looked at him. It left. And it was looking over his shoulder at the same time. You know what that means. So in a little bit, here come Mr. Big, a big bear. He walked right into the bait and didn't stop. I said, get your bow up. Don't draw it, but get your bow up. She got it up in place. Bear walked across and stood upright. Was sniffing at the bait. It was up a tree. Then he dropped back down on all fours and went back over to the corn pile, or bait pile he had there. And we just stopped long enough the bait pile. I said, go ahead and hit him, hit him. She drew back and shoom, I knew where that arrow hit, right behind his shoulder, and zipped right through him. And away went the bear, and boy, her mouth went blah, 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 blah. I said, be quiet, be quiet. I want to hear what's happening out there. I want to hear where the bear is at. And so finally we heard him make the moans. And she knew he had her bear, and I'm videoing all the time. Oh, she said, you got that, didn't you? You got that, didn't you? I said, yes, I got her all. I looked down, my camera was on standby. Oh, my. I said, well, sometimes I think it's just we're supposed to enjoy this stuff of our own.
That's very true. Yeah, very true. But
she's got it mounted today and is sitting in the bedroom. It looks good in there.
Yeah. What about you, Pap?
I had a lot of great hunts, but one of the best when this boy was with me and my wife Bonnie, and we were in Wyoming out in with my cousin Russell elk hunting. Now, we didn't have flintlocks then, but she had a 338 that I had made for her, and she was just little. She only 4'10".
Yeah.
And it had a muzzle brake on it and this little stock on it, about 11.5-inch pull or something. But Russell took us out to a place which was like strips of woods and an opening, maybe 50, 60 yards across, open, and then another strip of woods. And Russell said, Bonnie, I want you to go down toward this first opening. And he said, you just stand there. I don't think we were 150 yards from when she stopped. Boom, off on her rifle. So we turned right around and went right back up to her. And she said, I was watching over there. And she said, I thought it was just a big brown rock. But the brown rock got up. And she hit it with that .338, and it only went up in the woods maybe 50 or 60 yards and dropped dead. So the big brown rock turned into a pretty nice boil.
Yeah.
And she was quite a hunter. She killed, oh, yeah. She killed a lot of deer.
But I should say, we didn't even mention that we're sitting in Keith's workshop right now. His makeshift workshop where he does all his gunsmithing, leathersmithing, engraving. And so it's pretty cool to record a podcast right here where you get your work done.
It's a hobby shop now. We've retired for the last 10 years. We've been retired for 10 years.
Since we're sitting with probably two of some of the best flintlock shooters there ever was. Keith, you mentioned shooting an antelope at 225 yards and... You know, I still fool around a lot with flintlocks, and that's, people ask me all the time, how far can you shoot an animal with a flintlock, you know, or how lethal are they? And the furthest I shot one with a rangefinder, 167 yards, white-tailed deer, and as you mentioned, it doesn't take much to kill a deer. But, Ub, I know you've shot some long distance with some flintlocks, and I know you, what's the furthest, not that it matters, but just for people wondering.
Well, I don't think I shot any shots further than that, but probably one of the best shots I ever made was down on Treasure Mountain at a festival we were at. At that time, you had to, like, throw your knife, and they had a stopwatch, you know, and they would stop this going. So you'd throw your knife or your hawk first, either one.
Mm-hmm.
Then you would go up to station one and you would shoot, and you had to load and move. And I remember one of the best shots the Lord ever made through my eyes and mind and finger. They had a pop can hanging at 100 yards on a string. I leaned against a tree. I hit that beer can or pop can, whatever it was, at 100 yards. Reloaded and come up to the next station and then into the final station and then throwed my hawk or knife, whichever one was left, and they hit the stopwatch. Now, I wasn't the fastest man through, but I hit most of the targets where I needed to hit in the 100-yard one to give me the win that day, and I have, maybe it wasn't one of my longest shots, but it was my favorite shot.
Right.
But my experience with flintlocks, I guess, and Keith can verify this. Think back, Daniel Boone, Crockett, and them guys. That gun was their life.
Right.
You had to know that gun. You had to understand that gun. You had to live with that gun. You had to figure it out just the same as you figured out a partner that you was hunting with, that you depended on them for your life. Think about being out there with a flintlock, single shot, possible bag, raining, like he said, figuring out how to keep my powder dry, how to do all this, because my life depended on it. And that gun was the same as your hunting buddy if you had one. You had to know that gun, know everything about it. This gun and I have lived together and hunted together and shot together.
Mm-hmm.
I shot well because I practiced a lot.
We need to talk, why you guys had this obsession. You didn't only love flintlocks, you were making them for competition and what you guys go on, why you probably had a market for these guns back then. What was going on during that time period?
Okay, Ann and I went to shows every weekend trying to get a reputation. I'm shooting a pound of powder a month to try to keep me, to really study this gun and find out what it takes to make it shoot right. And one time at Friendship Indiana, the national matches, I was competing in the nationals then. I won several matches in the nationals with my rifle. And I noticed one time all these people was crowded around this person over here, and he was noted to be one of the top shooters in the area. And oh my gosh, they was just rolling over and asking him a million questions. And I was waiting to get my turn because I want to get educated on what it takes. So finally, people filled it away from me, and I went up to him. And I said, John, can I ask you a couple questions? And he says, sure, anything you want. I said, what caliber do you like the best for competition shooting? He said, oh, about any of them. I said, I shoot a 50 caliber. Do you like the 50 calibers? He says, yes, I like them okay. I said, how many 55 X's have you ever shot with a 50 caliber rifle? He looked at me steady. He says, I've never shot a 55 X in my life. And I thought to myself, I don't need to talk to this guy. Because I've been shooting 55 X's every weekend, you know.
You got to describe these competitions, rendezvous.
Rendezvous. Yeah.
That's what I've been trying to pry out. Yeah.
And that's kind of a lost art. Yeah, go ahead and describe the rendezvous and how you got down that path.
I ended up building my own buckskins, and my wife Bonnie built her own. And it was a simple process if you think about it. So I had a lot of fun making my own stuff like that.
I was so busy with guns in the shop early days, and done most of all the leather work. And she made pants, and she made shirts, you know, jackets, and she done bead work for us and everything like that. But she kept real busy with that stuff. So.
And you went to a rendezvous just about every weekend?
We went every week. My kids, my poor kids, I feel sorry for them because we was going to shoots every weekend.
Man.
And shooting. But as far as the accuracy is concerned.
Was the rendezvous, were they mainly in West Virginia, or were they all over?
Oh, no. They were in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia, and... That's about as far as we go in those three states. There was lots of rendezvous.
So you guys had to meet some wild characters at these rendezvous. I've heard a name, and I remember he was a world champion bear trap barefoot setter or something like that.
John Wilkinson from Ombers Nursery over in the Ombers, PA. Never forget it. Met him back in, that would have been probably be in 1964. He was in one of the rendezvous somewhere, and somebody had eagle feathers, which, you know, as John ended up with them, I don't know if he bought them, how he got them, but he had the federal government after him for quite a while till he proved himself that he wasn't the one that killed this eagle.
Uh-huh.
Now, that is a true story.
Well, he said that he laid in an elk's rib cage in Yellowstone and grabbed these.
Well, he was quite a storyteller, but
Tim Nolfe was another one.
Tim Nolfe, he was, there was no end to his stories. No, remember, he ended up being a pretty profound knife maker, but...
He is a character. He done some beautiful work on knives, didn't he?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I don't know anybody could make a knife like he could. He told me one time, he says, I don't know what I'm going to do with that wife of mine. I said, what's the matter? He talked rough all the time. He says, well, she's mad at me because I have water in my shop and piped in the shop, but there's no water piped in the house yet. And he says, she has to carry her water from my shop up to the house to wash the clothes with. And he says, so one day, he said, I don't know what she's hollering about, because one day I was in town, and I thought about that, and I thought, oh, I'm going to do something to help her out. So I went and bought her 2 5-gallon buckets so she wouldn't have to make so many trips.
Yeah, that was Tim.
And you know, now we might be joking like that, but I would say he done that.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
I'd say it's a real thing for him. Yeah. That was Tim Nolfe every year.
How many people would be at the rendezvous and then at the nationals, you think, shooter-wise?
In the early days, if you had 30 to 40 shooters, in the latter days now, just before COVID hit, if you go to a shooting match, you'd have 200 shooters on the line. We used to have shoots at Winchester. You'd have right at 1,000 camps. You had your own police. You had streets and stuff like that. And probably 200 people have all kinds of goods. You could buy barrels. You could buy anything.
Everybody in full guard, pretty much.
Everybody in full guard.
That's...
Yeah. It was something to see and to experience. Ann and I carried a teepee a lot with us all the time. Easy to set up.
Right.
Very easy to camp in. We enjoyed the teepee, and I've lived through 3 teepees. You know, you wear them out after a while. What happened? They rot off on the bottom. We had a 16-footer to begin with, and Ann and I and the 3 kids would stay in it real well. It had a floor in it and everything, and it was real comfortable. We have a fire pit in the middle of it, and easy to tear down, easy to put up. You need to take care of. Then I went to an 18-foot lodge, and we had an 18-foot lodge, and we was in Oakland, Maryland. And in order to keep it, if you went out and used it and it got wet, then you come back home and you just reset it up at the house inside our shop. And when we had that set in our shop, about every Sunday morning, we'd look out, and there'd be a whole bunch of people in that teepee. before we hardly when we ever got up. This lady walked over to me one time, and she was petting my horse across the fence. And I said, "Ma'am, be careful. That fence there that you're leaning against is hot." And she looked at me puzzled. And then she went back to petting the horse again. All of a sudden, she jumped back. She said, "It's not hot. It's got electricity on it." But anyway,
you live and you learn, I guess. Yeah.
We had some interesting people to come to the shop, and people from National Geographic come and spent a week with us one time. And they went to rendezvous, they got to see everything, and they wrote a book. They had a book, and some of the Meshick Browning stuff is in that book with them. I have a couple of copies of it at home. I built a rifle for Charlton Heston. Susan Howard has one of my rifles, still shoots it today. And several.
Who's that?
Susan Howard. She was a star on the movie or the sitcom and TV called Dallas.
Oh, okay.
The old show Dallas. She was a big supporter for the National Rifle Association. I built her a rifle, but a lot of people like that has got rifles around it.
I know. You know, we talked about building rifles, and I was hesitant to get in it. But just since you said that you built one for Charlton Heston, and that was the one that he held over his head, right in the famous picture, you'd have to pry it out of his cold, dead hands.
Yeah,
I knew that. But when you started building rifles, you could buy the parts for $100 and turn around and sell it for $200 when you was making $25 in the coal mine. Over time, I know some of your rifles have brought some pretty big money, even after they've left this shop and been sold and resold. And I think one of them ended up at Sotheby's auction one time, right? I remember you telling me a story or something along those lines.
They are starting to float around now. Those people that bought their rifle back in the 50s and 60s and 70s are dying off now, and so you'll start seeing them. If one comes to me, I had two rifles come to me last summer, and one guy had built his, I built his rifle for him in 1981, and built it for $2,500. I found somebody to buy that gun from him, and he paid $18,000 for it. And then his brother came to me right away. He said, "Oh, I'm the same way. I don't need this gun no more. I didn't get where the money, where, how much money?" So I sold his gun for $18,000 too. Yeah. But they're bringing good money. It seems like it's staying pretty good. I'm sure the economy will float around on them a little bit too.
Right.
But there seems to be a pretty good desire for them yet. But as far as accuracy, you talked about accuracy, and I work on that a lot. I really want to get the best out of the gun. Some time ago, I went on a dull sheep hunt. And to sheep hunting, you know, it's not long range shooting. And so I built this rifle with a elevator sight on the back of it with a slip bar underneath it that braces the sight up. And I sighted that rifle in at 50 yards. The first notch was 50 yards. And I snap it up the next notch. Is 100 yards, and 150, 100, 200, and 250. At 250 yards, a friend of mine come to me one day, and he said, "Keith," he says, "I built a bunch of Christmas decorations to put in the yard, and I have some animals left over. Would you like to have a couple of reindeers that you could put in your yard?" And I said, "Well, I don't know if I want any reindeers in my yard." Then all of a sudden, Donald Mouse said, "Go look at them." They were about the size of a goat, and he had them painted white.
Perfect.
I said, "How many of them you want to give me?" So he gave me a couple of them. I took them out. I didn't tell him this, but I took them out and set them up at 250 yards. And let me tell you what, you could just about figure the size of your hand is like to keep them bullets, you know, 250 yards with it.
Open sights.
Flintlock.
Now, I went sheep hunting, and we sheep hunted for 10 days, me and another fella. We didn't see rams for 10 days, and toward the end of the season, raining every day, keeping your gun dry. I'm carrying a flintlock. Finally, we see some rams. Make a long story short, we crawled up over the steep bank to look up over the top of the edge to see where the sheep were at, and there they were, off to our right, about 150 yards. They saw us as quick as we saw them, and away they went, running across that green, grassy slope there, heading for the mountains. And my buddy was carrying a 7-mag, and I threw my backpack over on the top of the ground. I said, "Take a rest." He grabbed his rifle and laid it down across my backpack, and I said, they'll stop, and the guide had my rangefinder, and he said 225, and they stopped at 325 yards. Boom, he shot down with his ram, killed it like that, 325. My ram kept on running, and the two of them together, Mine was a nice big ram, and his was, and there was a sickle head, they call him, right? The second one wasn't as big. He was heading for the mountains, and straight up the side of the slope, wandering through those rocks to get through an open gap that was right on top of it. And I knew I couldn't make that shot with my flintlock. So I threw the flintlock down, and I said, "Give me that gun." So he gave me his 7 mag, and I threw the 7 mag and laid it over top of my backpack, and bolt was open, no bullets in it. I said, give me a bullet. He gave me a bullet. Now my ram was climbing up the side of that mountain, getting ready to pop through a hole on the upper side, and I wouldn't see him no more forever. So he finally gave me a bullet, and I slapped it in there, only one bullet, and slapped it in the chamber and took aim. And I looked through the scope, and every ram jumped up on the ledge, and he stood broadside, the head to the left, butt to the right. A wind was blowing sharp, about 10 mile an hour to the right. I raised the rifle up, put the crosshairs on, and figured my elevation, and was sliding the crosshairs over, and as soon as the crosshairs come, the right edge was the edge of his body, I put my finger up on it, triggered, and boom, it went off. I thought, oh my gosh, I shot too quick, I shot in front of him. And the guide said, "Shoot again." And about time he said shoot again, we looked, and here the ram come rolling down through the rocks. But that bullet at 425 yards drifted my bullet to the right about 8 inches and dropped it right square through the hind behind his shoulder as if I'd shot him at 25 yards.
Did you tell
him? Not a muzzleloader shot, but it was a fantastic and this guy said, "Yahoo! Man, you boys from West Virginia can shoot," because he took his hat and he gave it a sword like that, and it went way down over the side of that mountain.
Did you ever tell him any different?
No. Never. But anyway, the reason why he said that you guys can watch when you really shoot is he saw 3 shots fired that week, and the first one was we were walking out one day and I was carrying a flintlock, and across the creek over there he saw a ptarmigan about 40 yards away, and he said, "Keith, you ever tasted ptarmigan?" I said, "No, I never have." He said, "Shoot that one over there and we'll take it in and cook it up." I thought, oh my, I'm so tired, and there's no place to get a rest. I have to shoot this crazy thing offhand. And I picked up the rifle, and he said, "Now remember, once you shoot its head off." Well, dump me. I just aimed for the middle of its body, and kaboom, I shot, and the feathers just flew, and Billy was with me. He said, "I'll go get your bird for you, Keith." So he went across the creek and went over and got the bird. And when he picked it up, he says, "You shot its head off."
But he said, "I know I did."
The bullet was about shooting that much high, you see.
That's where that I was aiming.
I aimed in the middle of his body, and it just took his head off. "You shot his head off." And I, what? I was as shocked as you. But the guy thought, "No, that's normal. That's what I asked you to do.
You boys from West Virginia can see."
But he saw that shot, and then he saw Billy shoot that ram. His was a 325, and he was using the meter all the time. And my ram was 425 yards, and I grabbed his rifle, which I'd never shot before, and just pulled the trigger before we're supposed to, and kill shielded the ram, you know. But the muzzle, I was confident 250 yards. I was confident 250 yards. If I seen him at 250, I'm going to hit him.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it. I'm going to hit him. But not at 425.
Right. Yeah.
Although there were shots fired, you know. In the Revolution, one day Washington told one of his commanders, he said, "I want you to," he said, "we called for the militia, the riflemen, to come and serve." And he was wanting to get 200 men for soldiers. And he looked out there and it's like 400 men there. And the commander said, "I don't know what to do, how to pick them." I said, "There's so many people out there. They're all got good rifles and everything. Well, we got 400 men out there." He says, "Well, pick the first 200. He says, "Put a target up and see which 200 can shoot the best." So they took a board and put a drawing of King George on it, and in vertical. And so they put that board out at 200 yards, and he came back and told Washington, he says, I got to do something else." He says, "I put that board out there, and they didn't just shoot King George, they shot his nose off." And they were that accurate, they shot his nose off. They had a whole big hole shot through where the nose was at. Yeah, there were shots recorded of long-range shots back then. We got better equipment and better material today. That was iron barrels. Those barrels were made of iron back then. They weren't steel like we've got today.
So did those guns get shot out, having iron barrels?
They'd get shot out, but they was pleased. They was pleased to see their barrel get shot out, because when you had a 36 caliber rifle,
okay,
and you shot that barrel out, what happens, there's a lot of carbon going on inside that barrel. And when you shoot at that barrel, mid for a micro thin section of that steel, it's white hot then back again. White hot, when you shoot it, it's white hot. And when you shoot it, you'll notice it sucks a lot of that. It's a void.
Yeah.
Then it'll suck the smoke back inside the barrel again. That's sucking carbon right back in. And that barrel would get carbon lined in the molecules of the inside of that barrel. So the man was going, he said, I'm pleased to get it done, because he knows that the next time he reams it out and gets it all rifled, it's going to be a lot of better shooter. They felt that way. I know better, because really, to me, a 50 caliber will shoot better than a 32 caliber. Just naturally will be, because it'll buck the wind better, the bullet's a little larger inside diameter, a little bit of disturbance in the bullet won't matter. Where a 32, if you go beating on the bullet too much, you'll deform it and it won't shoot as accurately. And so the larger caliber did help for him, but actually they had a good belief too that they're going to have a carbon steel barrel with the next time they ream it out and re-rifle it.
How did they rifle the barrels then?
All done by hand.
By hand.
Oh yeah, all done by hand. Many different ways to do it. They had all different types of rifling benches. Some were wood forms with a curvature in it. A good average twist would be twisting 48 to twisting 66, something like that. A twisting 66 barrel is strictly a round ball barrel. And what you can go twisting 48, just chances it'll shoot a conical bullet too, and as well as a round ball. A little more finicky with a round ball, but you can get them to shoot it. I shot a lot of 55Xs with a 50 caliber round ball.
On a 48 twist?
48 twist.
So, how many elk have you killed with your flintlock?
I killed 19 elk, and 9 with a bow and 10 with a muzzleloader.
9 with a bow and 10 with a muzzleloader.
I killed 2 in New Mexico with black powder.
Mm-hmm.
The rest, it was in either Wyoming or Colorado with regular rifles.
Rifles, yeah. Right.
I killed a lot of whitetail. I've killed, I think, 21 whitetail with my flintlock, and I haven't the last few years. I killed a pretty good buck 2 years ago with my Flint Power 243. But I've had fun with the flintlock,
yeah.
And they're a wonderful gun to shoot, and squirrel and turkey and deer. And
yeah.
But my main thing back with the flintlock back then was just rendezvous, this target shooting and mm-hmm. competition shooting. And
yeah,
I enjoyed it all.
Yeah, right.
The whole thing was blessed. God blessed us that they invented black powder before they did modern powder.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they did.
They invented black powder before modern powder, and you could hammer a piece of steel together, whether it was welded real good or not. That black powder, it would still shoot.
Right.
And you couldn't do that with modern powder today. It has to be got the best steel and everything else, and. But so we were blessed back then that with black powder.
Yeah.
Even some of the substitutes of powder that they're making today, we worked around some of them, because in some of my hunting areas that I had to go to, I couldn't get the black powder, so I had to use synthetic powder. And synthetic powder don't work good in a flintlock rifle.
Right.
But I always had a priming horn with me, with black powder in it, and you can put, if you put a prime of black powder down inside first, and then go ahead and put your supplement powder like
Pyrodex or triple seven,
which you'll shoot just as good as you ever did.
Yeah. Just put a little bit of black powder in.
But you charge the black powder down in enough to pick up the fire.
And the same charge with the synthetic.
Yeah.
So if you was shooting 75 grains, you'd load it 75 grains.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I know you killed a train load of bears, I think, too, hadn't you?
I've killed a bunch of bears. I don't know. and we use it. It's not that we don't use. I mean, Ann makes a really one of the best meatloaves you'll ever taste. Barra meatloaf is the best that you'll ever taste. And of course, we saved the hides and made them up. All the kids have bear hides, rugs, and her sister and everybody got bear hide rugs. We got a couple around.
Right.
I think bear meat's, depending on what it was feeding on, but it's an underrated table fare for sure.
And you can tell real quick when you kill a big bear, you know yourself, when you kill a big bear and you skin it out, if it has some odor to it, it's not going to be any good.
Yep.
You know, but if you get a sow or a young boar, it's just like anything else. If you take a tame hog, and it's an old boar, he ain't gonna be fit to eat. And when you can make up that meat, it'll be strong and everything else. But we made use of it as we possibly could. Now, most of the time, if we cleaned up a bear, then we cut all the fat off of it we possibly could and save all the fat. Because, you know, the entrails, in the fall of the year, the entrails might only be the size of your little finger. But there'll be fat on the outside of that entrails. There'll be 3 inches of fat all the way around that entrail that takes him through the winter. But we saved all that fat and took it up and gave it to the Amish. They just tickled to death to get it because they turned into soap, you know, make soap and stuff with it.
Lots of things.
You didn't render the fat down?
Oh, I have done it for fun, render the fat down to use it for grease on your leather shoes.
Yeah.
And it works pretty good. There's other substitutes that'll work better, but it worked pretty good. Mm-hmm. Like in your moccasins, if I wore moccasins in the wintertime and the snow was on or wet weather, I had two pair of moccasins. You have your inner ply and then your outer ply. And so you strip off your outer ply, your moccasin, which might be elk, but the inside ply would be moose. Moose don't stretch around, it's thicker. And then you could grease it all up with bear grease all over that second ply. Then slip your other outside ply on and lace them up, and then put a little bit of grease on them to help them through the day, but it won't last all day. But it won't get through to your inner ply.
Okay.
By having that grease between the two of them, then you'll have a good winter moccasin.
So you wore moose hide as your inner ply?
Yeah, moose and buffalo was two different plies. Buffalo works really good as either one, the inside or the outside, because it's a little thicker and a little more blubulous, you know, a little spongier. But it don't stretch like deer and elk will stretch. If you stand on deer or elk, it'll stretch double the size practically in the wet weather.
Oh.
And you'll slide around like it's really mushy like. But not so with the buffalo and moose. So that makes you a good set of moccasins. But you don't sell them together. You always want to keep them so you can take them apart. Because if you do get them wet inside, it takes forever for them to dry over a fire. You'll ruin them, burn up your outside ply trying to get the inside dry if they're tied together, glued together. So you have them separate, so in layers. So you can take them apart and you can put them over a stick and set them with the fire and dry them all out.
Right.
And then put them back, put the first one back on and grease them all up good, put the second one over top of it and lace it tight, and you're good for the day.
Yeah, and that's weird to think that these guys would meticulously probably do this most evenings, probably taking care of their footwear, because it would just wear out. I know I wear mountain boots out in 1 year.
Well, we have all kinds of writings in ancient books that we have around, and some of the things that I noticed more of anything is they said any time that an Indian or a mountain hunter had a chance to put his feet to the fire, he did so. That was because of wet feet all the time.
Wet feet all the time.
All the time, yeah. Well, if it only lasts one day, you'd be bear greasing them things up constantly.
Yeah.
What would they store the bear grease in back then?
You could put it in any kind of container. It didn't spoil on
it
you
didn't
or anything.
Spoil.
You could put it inside of a buckskin bag, or you take the paunch out of a animal and tan the paunch up and use it for like a water. It's watertight. You could store grease in that.
You didn't use any bear grease as your patch lube?
I've used it for patch lube. I don't like it for patch lube because you get it all over your fingers and you got it everywhere. You have it everywhere. I don't like it. I just spit patch them.
Mm.
When I'm hunting through the day, I just pick the patch up and just spin it around, just what the outer edges of it, not know what the middle, what the outer edges, and she was right down.
What thickness patch? Did you change that over time?
No.
Or did it matter on the rifle?
15,000 patch is what I use all the time.
Now, would you use them?
Yeah. I use the ticking.
Ticking
patch. Like, not it all. It has sizing on it when you buy it new. So then you wash it and it gets nice and soft, and set it on top of your barrel and put the ball in, seat it a little bit, and trim the extra off, and you had a perfect seal around it where that made better than a round patch, and you might get it off a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I shot competition.
They started manufacturing these patches all the time, so you wouldn't have to cut them. But they are, you have to really be careful how you put them down. And then they started making these patches that are lubed, continuously plumbed, pre-lubed. And that's not a good deal either. It's okay if you're on the range shooting or you've got things under control. But if you get out in the mountains someplace and the weather's really cold and you're hunting in zero weather or 10 degree weather, you pull one of those patches out and lay it on top of your barrel, it won't hardly bend.
Right.
Set a ball on top of them, you think you got the wrong size ball.
Right.
You think you got two patches together, but it's not, it's only one patch. So if I lubed one with using the lab, I lubed one side only.
Oh.
And I put it in a Sucretz can and closed it up, a bunch of them in a little Sucretz can. Lube one side only. And then I'll put the lube side down, it'll run right down. But if you try to use those lubed patches that's pre-lubed and hunting in the wintertime, it ain't going to happen.
So we have a muzzleloader season that just started a couple years ago in Montana, and that will be a good thing for any of our listeners that are coming muzzleloader hunting. Don't bring pre-lubed patches in the cold weather.
Yeah,
no. I wouldn't even thought of that, to be honest with you.
Well, the only reason I knew it is because I've been in that situation where those pre-lube patches in January back, you know, here when we had January.
You'd be going like this with them, thinking you got two of them together there. There's not, there's only one.
We just come back from a hunt with Josh and my son John and Levi, my grandson, and we hit some 26 below zero weather without the wind chill, which put it at 45 below. And I'm telling you what, it's tough to get used to in that altitude, you know, from back east going out there, get your lungs used to it, and then start breathing 10, 12, 15, 20 below. It was interesting hunt, but we did get two cats.
Yeah, I know. I saw some of the pictures.
I hunted in the northern part of the Nunavut territory. It's cold there too.
I bet.
We flew into, it takes 2 days to fly and to get there, but we flew into a place called Cambridge Bay.
So you were up there muskox hunting?
Yeah, it's an easy hunt. There was thousands and thousands of muskox. Everywhere you went, there's muskox right outside of town. They have a processing plant there at Cambridge Bay because they're allowed. The native people are allowed to kill muskox after the seasons are all over, but they're not allowed to kill trophy bulls. They can only kill cows and calves. And then they process the meat and smoke it and then dry it and put it in wrappers, and they ship it all over the world and sell that meat from there, muskox meat. And muskox is really good eating. It's like lean beef. It was a new experience, but it wasn't a hard hunt. They take you out. Guide has to be with you. There's a herd of muskox. Now you pick out what you want. And I asked the guide, is that a big one? Uh-huh, it's a big one. He wanted you to shoot one so he can get back home, you know.
They're all big.
That's a big one. Yeah, shoot him. He's got a big one. And
did you use a flintlock to kill the muskox?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I took my flintlock and hit the first flintlock to be in Cambridge Bay. That's it ever. This is far, we don't know of ever having anybody having in common with a flintlock rifle to hunt muskox. And so there was two of us went, Scott went with Timmy. Scott and I took care of your flintlocks. My bear that I killed in Alaska, a grizzly, somebody told me this, I didn't look it up myself. They said that bear killed with a flintlock rifle is the only bear to have been killed with a flintlock rifle in the 20th century. Now then, in the 21st century, a friend of mine, I built a rifle for him, and he went to Alaska and hunted bear, and he killed a bear with his. So both rifles that killed bear, his, mine's the 20th century, his is the 21st century, and I've built both rifles. That and $2 will get me a cup of coffee anywhere.
I guarantee it.
Yeah. I was fortunate to grow up young, 10 years old, probably starting with a flintlock and a bunch of guys like Frank Spade and everybody that knew how to shoot them. And those guys would get together. They would shoot their rifles, and then what they would do at the end was they'd let me shoot the last shot out of them. But what they wouldn't tell me, some of them was loading and some of them wasn't. Mm-hmm. So there'd be eight or 10 flintlocks there laying on a table, and I'd just take one after another. One might have a charge in it. One might just have the pan loaded, you know. So you knew that, boom, one would go off, and then the next one just, and you'd be flinching and no bang, you know. And that's when, like you say, keep your head down. Mm-hmm. And I taught myself just to stay there and aim until that gun went off, whether it went off or not. You know, you just keep your head and keep looking.
Keep your head down, you'd be okay.
Until this day, that's, you know, how I do it. I still flinch a little bit every now and again. But
I was running a match one day. And these were with American Mountain Men Association. All these guys were well-worn fellas. I said, come on out here, fellas. We're going to have a competition. So they come. I said, bring your flint and steels. I had it all set up. I said, now choose a team member. You guys grab a team member. And I had like 12 guys there, and I had better, so it was like 24 people there. Two and two. I said, okay, now I took my hat off and went out and said, give me your flint and steels. So they put flint and steels in my hat all the way through. Now they thought they was going to stir them all up and give them all one back, but I didn't. I held there and I said, now, down there about 100 yards, you'll see two boxes of pancake mix. And over here 100 yards is firewood. I want you guys to, the first team that can make me a pancake and eat it is the winner of this tomahawk. What? Go! They thought of it a little bit, and all of it took off for their camp as hard as they could go to get their rifle, because I had all their flint and steels. They run back and got their flint and steels, and the other guy, he took off as far as he could down through with his tin cup to try to get some pancake flour. He dumped some pancake flour in his tin cup and took the box and gave her a throw for the rest of the guys, you know. And then back up through there he went to get firewood. The other guys were the other getting firewood, and he brought the firewood back. He's got the, he don't have a flint and steel to build a fire, so he had his flint lock and clumped him about two or three times, and he had her, that had a fire going. And then he put that the fire at the, they take the tin cup then and have the lid on it. Now stir that mix up real quick and dump it over in the lid, and hold the lid over top of the fire right quick, and just as soon as it cooks a little bit of a pancake that big around, he grabs it up and eats it. Then he's the winner. And you'd be surprised that they would get a fire built and build that and cook that pancake in 3 minutes. By the time I say go, then one to run one way to get the flour and the other guy the other way to get the firewood and get that fire going without a flint and steel. Mm-hmm. And have it done in 3 minutes. I still have the books and all that competition we done. Like
is this
that.
An association, you said? The Mountain Man Association?
Yeah, American Mountain Man Association.
Still do you do that? Is that still going on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a big deal. These guys go through a lot. Yeah. And I hold the highest degree in American Mountain Men. It's a Hiverano. Plus, I'm a gray beard. A gray beard is somebody's 40 or 50 years at it, you know, now.
Sensei master, black belt and black powder, huh?
Yeah, yes, black belt and black powder. Yeah, I got you.
Yep.
Turn you loose in the woods for 2 weeks. What you have with you, no food, what you have with you is your camp, your rifle, tomahawk, knife, a little salt, and take off the woods and live for 2 weeks. Now you can't just go out there and camp for 2 weeks. You have to travel a certain amount of time, like 5 miles, and you have to go to have checkpoints. You have checkpoints where you check out. You're in the wilderness, and maybe you start from here, and in 3 days, I want you to check mark over here. Come out to the road and leave a note that you've been there. Then go on in, and maybe three more miles, you'll do the same thing. Then you go back in the woods, do the things, and then check mark. Says that something happened, so you break a leg or something. We can go back and we can find the last check mark you were at, so we know that you're between here and there to find you if something happens, but you're in there 2 weeks.
Did takes a pretty big chunk of ground. What'd you do that in, like dolly sods or something?
Dolly sods.
I figure.
Yeah. And southern West Virginia, down on southern West Virginia.
George Washington.
No, I used the headwaters of Cranberry River. Anyway, it's a big one way up in there. And we have mining camps and stuff like that. And I stayed up there for 2 weeks.
You get much interest on that now? Is it like dwindling out or
no, people? No, my goodness, it's going crazy. I'll give you magazines on it. I got magazine here if you want to look into it.
Yeah, heck yeah.
It's big out west.
Yeah.
Big out west because their guys will say, we're setting up a track and we're going to do 200 miles. And we're starting by horseback. And we'll go horseback so many miles and so many miles by canoe. And and it's all primitive. And they have to get special permission at some places where they stop to camp so that the police don't know that they're marauders or something like that. It was a big deal.
And what year did you do your 2 weeks?
Oh, I was probably 50 years old.
So you would just carry what was in your possible bag. What are some of those things that they, like a mountain man, would carry all the time in those?
You see a little salt. A salt horn. Some guys would carry a salt horn and a pepper horn too, but then you'd have all your other gear that would clean your rifle with, and have a slicker for winter weather. Rain or anything. And you also used it for your camp too. It's all one piece. Mine's 9x9, and I carry it with me. I still have it rolled up with a blanket inside of it right now. And you have all your other stuff inside you need, inside the blanket rolled up, and you put over your shoulder.
How much did that pack weigh?
10 pounds.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
You have a bag, a haversack bag. That's on one side that you carry your anything in that you want to carry, tools and stuff that you'd need. Tomahawk knife and candles, flint and steel.
Tinder boxes?
We train guys all the time. When you have a rendezvous with American mountain men, you don't sit out there and just over top of a fire and drink coffee and tell the tall tales. When you go to the American mountain men meet, there's classes, we call them colleges. If you go to a 2 week rendezvous with American mountain men, there's 2 weeks of classes. Classes on, like I trained the fellas one time to snare. Make a snare from what you have in the mountains. And how to find water when there is no water. Where do you find water? How do you make water when you're there? Like you can go to a grapevine. In this country here, you can go to a grapevine and hack it off. We don't cut them off of the ground. We cut them off about 5 feet high. And then take the top end of it and pull it down out of the tree. If you can get it down so you can bury it under a rock again, it'll take root again. You're not going to kill that plant. Take the other end that's out of the ground now and sticking up there, bend it over and tie it off to a tree, and it'll drip pure water.
Yeah.
In a tin cup for you, you'll have a tin cup full in about 30 minutes. I carry two things, a tin cup and a boiler. The tin cup is, it has a handle crushed in on it, but it's still got a lid on it. It don't have a lid. But I use that for, even when I elk hunt, I carry my boiler and a tin cup. These tin cups for a cup of coffee. The boiler, I dump oatmeal in. And two little packs of oatmeal in that. Put some hot water in, stir it up. Or you got the hot water heated up, and stir it up. I put my boiler on the fire first with some water in to get her boiling. Then I have a tin cup over here with a little coffee in it. And I go ahead and pour some in my cup until I get my boiler just right with hot water in it, and then dump some oatmeal in it, stir it up real good while my coffee's getting ready. And then oatmeal, I can eat that oatmeal down at breakfast. It might be 5 o'clock in the morning. It'll last me right on through lunchtime. That oatmeal is the best thing you can eat for out here for early morning. And then I got my cup of coffee. Then I'm ready to go. Put my tin cup back together and I'm back in my backpack. I'm ready to go. Now there's packs that they make today. You can carry out half a dozen of those for dried food.
Yep.
And you can carry enough on your backpack to last you a week. Today they make it a lot simpler. Can't use them out where I'm doing them or AMM.
If I were to do 2 weeks in the mountains, I can't get. I did it multiple times. I cannot get my backpack under 38 pounds, and that's all I'm buying some of the best lightweight technology.
38 pounds is pretty good. They're with everything.
And you guys are carrying 10 pounds of weight and making it as you go.
Well, we're living off the land too, you know. If I'll hit a creek bed someplace and I'll find some greens through there that you can eat. Edible plants right along. But a lot of things like the berries, if they're on, go to the edge of a field and you find plant and great salad. You have, for drinks, if you make a different drink, there's tea that you can make out of several things. You can make tea with it's good food and songbirds. Sure. I never ate a crow before, but robin has a nice breast on it. If you, if there's nothing else you got to eat, you'll look at that robin pretty good, you know.
Yeah.
You'll bring him down. and then you'll feel a couple of robins, and you're good for the day. But they teach you all that stuff there with American Mountain Association. We'll have meats where, and you know, in order to tune part of somebody, we never would embarrass a person in our camp. We don't try to embarrass him, but we try to get him to learn more. When you go into a camp, your clothing, your weapons, your moccasins, and everything should be within a 10-year time period. 1880, 1890, and things change in that 10-year time period. Clothing wear out in 10 years. So you'd have a 10-year time period you set everything up in. You wouldn't carry a percussion rifle in 1750 clothing, you see. And so, but you can carry a flintlock rifle in 1810. And that's the kind of stuff you watch. And these guys were... We'll go to their camp and they'll say, we'll get a campfire going. We'll say, okay, does anybody wants to check their camp? And they'll say, yeah, you can go come check mine. Give me about 10 minutes to get set up and go check mine. He'll have everything all scattered out and he'll check the camp and we'll go over his items. And if he finds something that's not right, we don't embarrass him with it. We'll say, we got a better one. We have a better one. We'll go back to camp and say, this is something you'd be better closer to it. Like they kept checking my camp one day. And someone had went to my camp and put a plastic comb in it. And when they scattered everything out, there was this plastic comb. Well, they routed me. Somebody ran back to camp and brought me a horn comb, made a horn, give it to me. I still have it. Now you're allowed certain things like toilet paper, if you want to bring that, that's fine. Anything sanitary or sanitation. Yeah. And glasses, we have... we won't pick on you if you're wearing a set of glasses trifocals or something in it. We prefer you to use glass. I have a set of round glasses. That's my great grandfather's glasses. And I took them to the optometrist and I said, can you put my lens in those glasses? And he looked them over and he said, nope, that's too small. I can't get them in there. Go ahead and make me up one. So he made me another pair and he said, I said, just put them in them cheap frames over there. So I did, and I brought them home and I measured them all out and knocked it all out. Put them on my diamond wheel here and ground them all down and put them in there. Took them back to him. I says, look at my glasses. And he said, who'd you get to do that for you? So I done it myself. You guys couldn't do it. And he took them and showed them all through the whole building. He said, it's competition now with us. I still have them in there. I got them in there. I used them yesterday. But I got trifocals in my little tiny glasses that was my great-grandfather's. I'm looking through the same lens my grandfather, great-grandfather used.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
I'll give you some information on AMM.
Okay.
It's a great organization. We have our museum out there. And we have three or four big plots of ground that we purchased up for our use. And if you're AMM, you can go there and camp anytime you want to. It'll cost you nothing. You can use it to hunt on if you want to. You can use it for fish on if you want to. It's all, and there's three or four plots of that out there that we got set up. It's a great organization, and you'd be perfect for it out there. It's harder for me to get to use it out there than what would be for you.
Right.
I used them before, like years and years ago, camp on them when they're going out there.
So some of these famous guns, what is one of the, probably the wildest old gun that you've got to handle over the years?
Magic Browning's rifle. He was a hunter from this area right here. Messick Browning, his rifle's in the Smithsonian Institute right now. And they brought it to, we had it brought out to a big show we had here in Friendsville, Maryland years ago. And we put it on display there. And I got to hold his rifle, got pictures taken with his rifle and everything. At that day, I met a lady there, Renee Cochise, is Cochise's great-granddaughter. Renee Cochise and I made trade that day. And we traded. I traded a hunting knife off my bag, off my side, for a family bag, a Cochise family bag. It's all beaded up and everything, and we have it upstairs now. So I got to meet her and met with some medicine men, too. I met with six medicine men. We talked about the medicine, Indian medicine out west. It's a completely different from what you might think it is. Mm. I said, oh, I'm surprised that you're doing it this way and that way. And this guy, because I said, I've read about it, and like your prayers always start in the west. Our prayers, we always thought your prayers started in the east. That's what we tell you, but that's not right. She says, where do you suppose fear was for us? Fear is anything coming from the west. Because we had no fear of anything in the east. There's no enemies in the east. All of our fear was from people coming behind us. And so our prayers start in the west. And we start a prayer in the west. And like it's cycled like the animals are cycled, or like our lives are cycled. The lives then cycle to the north, your hardships, from the west to the north. And then north is like a child starting to grow up, all the things he has to grow through to be able to become an adult. Then we go to the east when things start to smooth out for you in your 30s and 40s. And then your prayers go to the south, in this calmer area and the warmer climates for us older people. And that's where the prayers circle. That circle of life is starts in the west, north, east, and in the south. And that's how their lives are developed.
Hmm.
But all that stuff is trained in the AMM. They train your colors, what colors you use for what you're doing, what you represent when you have beadwork or anything done, and what the colors all represents. Like blue is always the blue sky. That's where God is at. And he remains there, and it represents, blue represents a godly atmosphere for you. Black, of course, the black is what they put under your eyes, you know, when you're playing football, make you fearsome, you know. Black is the darkness. Everybody has fear in darkness, dark areas in darkness. So black represents dark, the fear. And red is the bloodline. Red is always the bloodline. And when you use red in your beadwork and your quail work and so forth, it's always up and down. Because that bloodline connects you to God, or me to Him. That's the bloodline. That's your life. That's it enters the circle of life. And brown is the color it's used not too often, but it represents man himself. And so you can put your man in the sky in the red bloodline. And dark blue is a very precious bead to them, because that's where God is at. He's right there in the clouds, and the dark blue. And green represents the earth, Mother Earth, you know, all kinds. And then yellow, which means wisdom, and white is purity. White is the purity you use, and women would put white on their beadwork, purity, especially if they got married. And when you marry, you're in a white, ladies are dressed in white, that's purity, you see. That's a follow-through from the same thing that the Indians believed in, too. The women's dresses would be made of a sheepskin. When the mountain sheep, that was when it was all cured and everything, it was in the white, and they didn't smoke it or anything, and they left it in the white because it was pure. Mm. And that's what their dresses were made out of and things like that. But that's the kind of stuff they try to blend you in to become more and more earth-like, but you are connected with God, very much so. If you kill an animal, you're required to carry a certain amount of corn with you, and tobacco that you've prayed over, and offered this tobacco to God, that'll make it pure. You put it in a bag, and you keep that tobacco with you, tucked under your belt, and the corn also. And if you kill an animal, you go up to that animal with reverence. You don't go up there and say, I killed this big buck. It's God gave me this animal. He gave his life for me so that I should sustain my life. And so I'll do for him. So you take out a pinch of that tobacco. You sprinkle it around him because it's holy. And you provide a holy, sacred place for that animal to be at now, where he's at. Then you take a piece of that of the corn that you have and put it in his mouth to provide him with food on his way to the happy hunting ground. And those things, and if you do those things to those animals while you're living, one of these days when you take the walk to the happy hunting grounds, you won't have to face that animal. I don't want to face that grizzly bear up there. So I'll treat him with respect all through my time, all the way from the time I killed him till the time that he's still being mounted on the wall. That I'll show him with a lot of respect because I don't want to face him up there. You know, those are the things you're taught at the AMM.
These are the things that hunters today need to be taught, because we've lost a lot of that nuance and that feeling about hunting being connected to it. I see it guiding people all the time. It's a lot of times about just killing the animal instead of what you're just talking about, all these things that that don't have a whole lot of meaning anymore.
I've seen caribou hunters, when we caribou hunted north, and these guys go out there and shoot a caribou, a giant bull with racks that being out there, like beautiful things. The only thing he wanted was the first little, where the brow tines are out, saw it off at the head there, and then saw the top off and throw it away. I just want that little piece because it's the only thing that'll fit over top of my doorway in my office. Throw the rest away. It's not good. My buddy and I, Thermodon, was running around to all these camps where the people are shooting stuff, gathering up the meat, gathering up the stuff that we could get to use back home. And we had more meat than we ever used, but people was throwing it away. Yeah.
It's kind of neat that it comes full circle. You're talking about all the Indian things and the religions full circle, and these guns kind of make a full circle also. They get passed down through generations and generations, and like this gun, they just keep coming back around.
What culture do we have 200 years ago that's still alive today? What culture do we have?
Hunting.
It's gone. And because it was derived, through hardships. If you take an apron, 200-year-old apron, and pick it up and look at it, sure, it's old and worn, but there's a lot to be read by that. Somebody went through a lot to make that apron that direction, a wore-out apron. And that's the way with these old rifles. When I pick up an old rifle to restore it, I don't just pick it up and grab it and restore it. I look and study it over and see all these little things, little scratches on it, and little things where he changed out the sights for some reason, you know. He may have moved the sights closer up this way from where it was because his eyes are getting bad. He might have shortened the back end off the stalk because he's getting older now and he couldn't reach it like he could. He cut off the end of the barrel because it was getting worn, and out there he's worn it so much, you know, he cut it off, moved it back to where it lost the weight of it, you know. I think a lot of them old rifles was busted up whenever the culture changed from everybody walked or carried their rifle across the top of a horse's back. And they wore there in that area. You'll find them worn right there where they sat on the saddle all the time, laid across the saddle. But that means something to me, to feel that area where that was felt. They're like that, to touch that rifle and then to put it back into operating condition. What have we got making today that 200 years from now it'll be in operating condition? It's made of plastic and everything. It's in the ocean now, you know. Garbage. How quickly guns have developed. You know, now they've got them to... shooting rifles that will shoot flat for like 1,000 yards, because not when you shoot it, the powder charge ignites a little charge of something, I don't know, a nuclear or something, that projects that bullet even farther and flatter than it would ever have been before, or it would go like this. It's got a charge like a rocket now that projects it straight for a lot more longer distance, a mile away.
I use a long range rifle, but it seems like the farther we shoot, maybe the farther we get away from hunting.
All it is, you're just killing an animal that doesn't know you're there.
Yeah.
And you've lost that.
Yeah. We for sure have.
Yeah, it's become, you know, all about what we can do as quick as we can do it.
Yeah.
Talking about those old guns, I mean, they tell a story.
Yeah.
You know, there's a story in each one you look at. Mm-hmm. You know, something to be told. Brings a lot of perspective to why we do what we do.
I know whenever I grab hold of one of those guns, and if you have any bit of patriotic spirit in you, when you touch one of them, it just sends goosebumps up over you. They kind of scream freedom. It's kind of maybe weird to say, but they're sentimental. They're an art piece. They strike your heart differently.
I met a guy, brought his gun to a stock, my Woodstock shop down in Virginia, and oh, I'd love to have been able to buy that gun off of him, but it was a family piece and he didn't want to let go of it. But it was a Civil War rifle, and it had very delicately carved all the different engagement he was in, like battles. And it was covered from one side to the other, very nicely done. It wasn't just carved in there, it was carved with detail. All the different places like Gettysburg he'd been in, and the time and the date of it, and some of the Sharpsburg battle he had been there, and Philippi, West Virginia, and so forth. All these different battles, he had them all on there on his gun. That would have been what a study piece that would be. That thing could talk.
I believe that we lost that connection. I think people need to dig if our culture is going to continue, and we're going to, like you said about the nuance with the animals, instead we're worrying about our Instagram post while we're walking up to it instead of how we can make it better for the animals and hunting. I don't know how we can go much farther than what we have with our talking. You pretty much said it full circle. That's full circle. Like the book that you also,
right.
You have. I kind of saw the end there of our podcast as you were going through this circle of life thing, and these guns are just going to keep circulating.
Yeah.
Hopefully forever.
Yeah, little piece of history.
Usually we end with singing Happy Trails, but I'm not going to make you older gentlemen sing Happy Trails.
Well, thank you for having us, and we've enjoyed it.
I know I had to do some explaining of what a podcast was before we could get doing this, but it's pretty nice to see it all come together now.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm glad to be part of it,
yep.
For sure.
Yeah, this is some great audio history of it.
Oh. All right.
That's it. Thank you, guys.